From Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose Globalization Initiative lecture series presents The Global Food Court, Fast Food, Slow Food, Imperial Food, by John Pfeffer on Thursday, September 8th at 4 p.m. at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu.
You're listening to The Information Advantage. This is WILL Urbana. It's a broadcasting service of the College of Communications here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason, setting in this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine for Celeste Quinn. Our guest today is Ken Meter. Ken is the president of Crossroads Resource Center out of Minneapolis, and he's going to talk to us a little bit about farm aid and food and feeding programs, and we'll probably cover a lot of topics. Good afternoon to you, Ken. Thanks for joining us today.
It's good to be here.
Tell me, what is the Crossroads Resource Center?
Well, we're a nonprofit organization based in Minneapolis, and we really work quite a bit with inner-city communities and also rural communities trying to study the way money flows through a local food and farm economy, looking at some of the assets people have in their community, some of the ways that local folks can shape those to develop their food system so it works better for them.
What's the relationship with farm aid?
Well, the relationship really is that I got invited to come to Urbana on the 14th of September as the caravan of farmers starts to move from Urbana up to Chicago for the Farm Aid concert that will happen on the 18th. And I was invited because I've been doing some studies in various states of the country, including California and Hawaii and Iowa and Minnesota, to look at the economics of farming, and people in Illinois thought that this would be important data to sort of spark a discussion and a sense of energy among the farmers going up to Chicago.
And just for our listeners' purposes, and I think many of them will be familiar with Farm Aid and what that concert series is and has been over its inception since it first started, I think, in 1983?
It was 20 years ago, actually.
Yeah, 85. You're correct. 20 years ago in 1985 here in Champaign at the Assembly Hall. And Willie Nelson and some of his friends in the entertainment business has gotten together and decided that the farm crisis of the 1980s was not something that was acceptable to them and that they might be able to raise funds to help farmers who were in dire straits.
Well, the crisis was really putting a lot of families out of their farms, and you had farmers who were raising food being so broke they really needed to go on food stamps, some very horrible situations back in the mid-80s crisis. So Willie and the other musicians who decided to do Farm Aid in 1985 really felt that they had to raise money just to help families survive through one of the deeper farm crises that the United States has experienced.
Tell me about your research.
Sure. I work a lot with community groups that are trying to make sure that fresh and healthy food gets directly from farmers to local consumers. And there are really thousands of efforts all around the United States to do this. But my specialty has been to give people a sense of how is money flowing through your locale? How do you actually grab a hold of some of that money to divert it to the right people, the farmers, making sure farmers get a good price from consumers, making sure that the transactions that really revolve around food not only build health for the consumers, but also some wealth for your community.
And what have you found as you've looked at different regions of the nation?
Well, it's really very striking, Todd. We've been doing studies now, and it's interesting how this works because I get invited by a local group that says we want to do something in our area, and then we really don't know the findings until we dig it into the data and look at it. But there's a very kind of disturbing pattern all around the country that farmers are really quite systematically losing really immense amounts of money producing their crop. In fact, the farm economy is in much worse straits now than it was 20 years ago when Farm Aid kicked in. Farmers are losing much more money producing lots of crops, a net loss of over $40 billion a year in the United States for all farmers. And you look at regions in the Grain Belt, and that's really where the heart of the losses are. It's very ironic because the very places where farm productivity has doubled in the last 35 years, farm income has declined maybe four or five times. It's really a very stark contrast.
You're taking out all the government help when you do this?
I'm taking out government subsidies. Because that's really, in my mind, the measure of the real strength of the farm economy is whether farmers are making it on the production of the crops that they grow.
And just how much do you, for a commodity farmer in the Midwest, I assume that's what you're working with, a corn and soybean rotation farmer, what kind of income drop does he have if you take out the government subsidies in a percentage?
Well, I can't give you a percentage, but what I can say is
it's about 40%.
The subsidies, as you say, only cover a fairly small proportion of the losses the farmers incur. So, if you look at the economics, you see that farmers are increasingly having to go to other sources of income, other jobs that are off the farm, in order to pay for the costs of farming. And what's, I think, most dramatic is that the regions where those losses are the greatest are exactly those regions where the commodity programs are in place, so that in really the most prosperous farm regions right now are the ones that are off the farm programs, because people would not grow a crop without having a price for it like they can with the commodity programs today.
Has FarmAid developed some kind of policy setting team that they're working with to reference your materials, or are they just talking about these kinds of numbers in order to garner income to help those they feel need helped?
Well, I've known people at FarmAid, you know, since 1986, and so I, while I've been real supportive of the effort, we've really never worked directly together until this year. But I think increasingly in the last couple of years, what folks at FarmAid have found is that the data I'm coming up with is data that farmers and rural communities are ready to hear, so that the partnership here is to help me get to Illinois to meet directly with Illinois farmers. And just to say, you know, here's the situation. I think one of the things that's going to be on our minds on the 14th will be, what were the economics of farming like in 1985 when this crisis was in place then, and how much worse is it now than then? And you find that for all the organizing farmers have had, for all the money that FarmAid has raised, farmers really are in much more desperate straits.
And can you compare the two for me, please?
Oh, it's much deeper. And usually I work with charts, and so I can kind of show here.
Oh, sure. Well, if you talk to me about it, and I think we can probably get it across.
For instance, in the state of Minnesota, farmers in the last 11 years have lost $7 billion raising farm commodities. And in the state of Iowa, farmers have lost over $4 billion in the last 4 or 5 years raising farm commodities. Those are immense losses of money from two of our prime farm states in the Grain Belt. And it turns out that Minnesota and Iowa are, in fact, the two states that have lost the most in the last 35 years in terms of the balance of the farm economy. Illinois, I haven't studied yet because this will be my first trip to Illinois, but we hope to look at some similar data. And what I can tell you is I think every county in Illinois has really in worse shape now than it was 35 years ago.
Recap
that productivity doubling.
Recap those numbers again for me from Minnesota and Iowa.
Sure. If you look at the last 11 years in the state of Minnesota, farm production costs have exceeded cash income from farming by over $7 billion. And in the state of Iowa, over the last 4 or 5 years, the same farm production balance has been negative to the tune of well over $4 billion.
And so you're telling me that the income from the government has made up much of this, and that's the reason that producers aren't going out of business in droves?
Well, no. I mean, actually, the government subsidies do help some producers, but most of the subsidies go to a small number of large growers, so they tend to help some people disproportionately. They really don't help the local food economy very much. And what's really carrying farms through is not the federal programs as much as finding other work.
So that most farmers, and you're not talking about finding other work where they're producing food. You're talking about finding off-farm jobs.
Well, both. Some farmers are increasingly doing things like renting out their land to neighbors because you can actually make more money renting out land than farming in many places. Some people are doing custom combining work or other labor exchanges with their neighbors, and that's a source of income that helps them compensate for the losses of farming. But, of course, increasingly farm families are turning to at least one member of the family, if not more, just finding work off the farm. And the figures I have don't even include those numbers. But there's a terrific amount of money farmers have to earn in order to compensate for the losses they suffer with the sort of farm economic system that they're all working in now. And what you find is the losses we're experiencing today are far deeper than we had in 1985 during the farm credit crisis of the 80s, which in most people's minds is the worst we've known of the farm economy.
Yeah.
But I think farmers have enough other sources of income now that they sort of notice their farm's losing money, but they find other ways to make do by having other jobs or having other income, so that the losses are not quite as immediately crushing to families as they were in 1985.
I guess I'm having trouble here, and my experience would be Illinois and Indiana farmers, but Iowa should be fairly close, and maybe typical Minnesota farm, although they have more livestock in both of those states than certainly Illinois does. Are you capable of garnering out of your numbers how much of the income that they've got coming in is coming from livestock, so that you can figure out? I'm just having trouble trying to say that the current era is worse than the 1980s crisis. That there are things that aren't happening now that certainly were happening. The price of land is very high now, but of course you're not paying 17%, 18%, 19% on that land in interest, which is something that was happening in the late 70s when purchases were made, but in the crisis time, they were still paying out those large interest payments, and those were just crushing for producers at that point, and that the banks were trying to come up with income out of those land purchases, and it was just crushing, and it seems to me that you'd have a hard sell in Illinois to say that now is tougher than it was in 1984, 85, 86.
Well, and I wouldn't say that farm families are necessarily suffering as much today as in 1985, because in 1985 you had the situation wasn't so much. I mean, it was certainly partly the interest rates being high, but also what you had happen in the mid 80s was a result of a cycle that started in 1973. When oil prices were raised, what we thought were quite high prices, I think it was up to 25 cents a gallon in 1973. We thought it was a steep increase. And because we were paying so much more for oil during the OPEC energy crisis, America made a policy of using farm commodities as a way of bringing foreign exchange into the country by selling commodities we could get hard currency for abroad. And that created some very windfall incomes for lots of farmers for about 2 years. But if you look at the production data that I'll be showing on September 14th, what you see is the result of that was about 2 years of very good prosperity for farmers, the best we've had since 1969 when this data is available. And then immediately it trails off and gets quite a bit worse. But the other thing that happened was that not only were interest payments high in the late 70s, I remember in 1978, 79, interest rates were as high as 22%.
Mm-hmm.
But farmers were being encouraged by federal lenders. And I was a reporter at the time interviewing people who'd
to
gone into their federal lending agency and said, we need, say, $250,000 of loan to improve our farm operation. And the lender would say, well, that's too little to loan you. We want to loan you $450,000.
You bet.
And what happened was people began to take on more debt than they could carry because the price was there and the sort of illusion that global markets were going to carry them through was there. So people got into big debt trouble because they were taking on much more debt than the farm economy really could justify. And it took about 12 years for that process to cycle back and hit us. But farm debt in the United States peaked in 1985. It was, hundreds of billions of dollars of debt carried by farmers. And what's interesting was we had that whole expansion after the grain for oil days where farmers got more productive. They produced much more crops. They were selling more crops. But they were taking on so much more debt that their farm operations became more shaky because they were actually increasing the debt as they got more productive instead of reducing their debts over time. And if you look at the data that I have, what you find is farms only became healthier in terms of this farm production balance of getting enough money for their production costs because they renegotiated debt with the lenders. And as we had the whole effort, as farmers sat down with lenders in the mid-80s and said, if we don't renegotiate our debts, write them down, the banks will fail and the farms will fail. So people reasoned that was a good policy, and they sat down together to reduce the debt burden. That really helped the farm economy get back on its feet. But it still never really recovered because since those days, there's been a fairly steady downslide of the income from farming. And you mentioned crops and livestock. What you also see in the data is that, again, in Minnesota and Iowa, because I haven't studied Illinois yet, but I expect to find a similar pattern when we do that. In Minnesota and Iowa, both states, the amount of income from livestock has plummeted over this time. Meat consumption is slightly higher. Prices are much higher than they were. But the production of meat and the ability to make wealth in a farm community from raising animals, which is a very natural process of increase, has been moved out of our farm communities to larger feedlot operations elsewhere. And the price structure isn't there to give farmers a good return for that. So really, a lot of these losses we're tracking are about livestock more than about crops.
I wondered about that. So that, for instance, in the state of Illinois, you'll find when you look at the numbers that the number of hogs produced in the state of Illinois has actually grown. But the number of farmers has dropped off dramatically. And I'm talking about by huge, huge numbers, not by small numbers, because of the consolidation within that particular industry.
And what you're finding is that not only are the numbers of animals increasing, but the ability for the communities where those animals are raised to actually make wealth from producing those animals is plummeting. So that you have, again, we can produce hogs very efficiently in this country. Very well-developed systems that are quite effective, but they don't bring wealth to rural communities the way that they did, say, in the 1950s.
Why?
Oh, essentially because farmers no longer have a price margin that's adequate to bring money back into their operations, and partly because the processing of those animals and the systems that feed those animals and take care of those animals are increasingly devoted to paying money outside the farm community itself. So that what you have is this extractive engine, which is what we call our farm economy, taking billions of dollars of wealth out of rural communities every year, and far more than federal subsidies replace. So essentially, farmers are subsidizing the national economy, in fact, the global economy, by producing their crops. And we have a very vibrant discussion in this country about whether farmers getting dependent on farm subsidies, but we don't talk about the fact that my life as an urban American is also dependent on farms subsidizing my lifestyle by raising crops at a loss, crops and livestock at a loss.
Explain that.
Just what I say. I mean, if Minnesota farmers are losing $7 billion in the last 11 years producing their crops, they're spending a lot more money buying farm inputs, producing their crops and livestock in ways that they don't get a return for. Well, that money goes into national and global financial systems and gets used elsewhere. It may help someone build housing in an urban area in Minnesota or in Chicago or in Atlanta or even develop a shopping center in Tokyo or Paris. And farmers really are the backbone of helping that capital flow because of the interest payments they pay on very large farm loans.
It seems to me that you might make a very good a case for the transfer of wealth taxpayer dollars to producers for subsidies in that case?
Well, I mean, the subsidies are, they're essential because I think the economics of the commodity system we have really do favor the people who are in the middle, so that the folks who are buying the raw materials at low prices and buying commodities and trading them and processing them for added value, they are in a more favored financial position just because of the structure of the economy. And so, yes, in a way, we have to subsidize rural communities in order to compensate for those losses. But I think what's interesting is the subsidies themselves are producing even greater losses because they're encouraging production at a loss. They're making it feasible for the costs of farming to go up, even while farmers are bringing less money in themselves. There was a study in Iowa completed last year that showed that 46% of the price of land in Iowa is due to the subsidy structure, so that subsidies also make land expenses higher. My data, if you come on the 14th of September, you'll find that our subsidies are as much as subsidies to lenders because they keep the flow of interest payments going as they are a subsidy to farmers. Subsidies have encouraged farms to get bigger than is really efficient as a farm operation because the money was there to promote that expansion. So they've really distorted our local rural economies in ways that are not healthy for our communities, not healthy for our farms, and make it very difficult for a younger generation of farms to settle into production.
You've mentioned the state a couple of times. What is it that you'll be doing on the 14th of September, and where, and who's invited?
Well, I'm coming down to Urbana on the 14th, and actually I don't even know who's invited, but it's an event sponsored by the University of Illinois. And, you know, frankly, I can't even tell you the room, so you'll have to find that out and tell people what the room is going to be. But I will be coming down to a meeting which is the kickoff for this caravan of farmers who are going to start in Urbana, and basically as claiming the heritage of the first farm aid and saying, we started in Urbana 20 years ago. We want to come back to those roots, but we're going to have the new Farm Aid concert in Chicago. So we're going to caravan from Urbana to Chicago over several days. So farmers will go up to Danforth and to other towns in Illinois on the way to Chicago from Urbana on Thursday night and Friday night on their way to the concert. This event is a kickoff for all that. And I'm basically coming down to what I think will be some university people, some students, some members of the community of Urbana, and hopefully lots of farmers who are going to be ready to caravan. And I'm just going to be talking with them in a very honest way and saying, here's the data I'm finding from Minnesota, from Iowa, from other states, about the structure that farmers work in that's really not working for it's not creating wealth for rural communities effectively at all. In fact, it's creating a lot of wealth for people outside of those areas. And I'm going to say, you know, here's what the situation was in 1985 when the first Farm Aid concert was held. And, you know, things are worse now, and we better start talking about how we make this a more sustainable farm economy. And I'm also going to talk about some of the other imbalances of supply and demand, because I'm not looking simply at farmers, but if you look on the consumer side, there's some very kind of outrageous things happening. We have half of the school children in the United States right now unable to afford school lunches. So they qualify for free and reduced prices for school lunch because their family income is too low. You have terrific costs associated with obesity, with diet-related diseases. You have two-thirds of Minnesotans right now, I think basically two-thirds of Americans are overweight in some way. You also have one of every 10 families wondering at some point during the year whether they will have enough to eat. So you have these, you know, incredible discrepancies between people who are eating way too much food, really losing a sense of where food comes from and how to produce it safely, how to cook it safely. And you also have farmers producing a lot of very wonderful crops at a loss. And you have people going hungry at the same time. So those things have really become very compelling reasons to fashion some local food systems that allow us to have producers dealing directly with consumers and talking directly about how to make sure that farmers are well compensated, that consumers get healthy food, that really we have a healthy system and a sustainable system over time instead of one that's taking wealth away from us.
Tell me what you envision in that kind of system.
Well, it's not really what I envision. It's really happening all over the United States. You have thousands of efforts, mostly centered in the New England to Mid-Atlantic to Ohio to Minnesota, Illinois area, but also quite a wealth of activity out in California and the Pacific Northwest, and some good activity in the Appalachians, of people forming things like community-supported agriculture farms, where consumers buy a share of the farm or buy a share of produce or of meat for the year and say, I'm going to pay up front for this food so that the farmer has the money to use to plant the crop and to raise the livestock, and then the consumer gets food as it's produced during the year. You've got people in school districts all over the United States saying that schools or colleges or hospitals should be buying food directly from local farmers, because a terrific amount of the price of our food is actually a cost of buying energy, because we have so much energy around and transporting our food. It's the average item of food travels 1,500 miles between the farmer and the consumer, and as our energy prices go up, we can't afford that. We have people who are doing new farmers markets, new beginning farmer initiatives to help younger farmers find ways of buying land against very steep land prices and very high input costs. So it's a whole cluster of activity that's going around to basically reconnect us to our food producers, to create more of a sense of community around food, more of a sense that we really eat to celebrate health and to get to know each other and to celebrate our cultures as much as to pay the bills.
Can you do that on a large scale? I mean, it seems to me that corporate America would not be capable of developing such a network, and that I've seen, of course, these networks here locally, and that they don't work they work well for the people that are involved, but they certainly would not work very well for mass distribution.
That's a real challenge about how do you do this in a way that produces healthy food at a fair price for the farmer, but also is affordable to the average person. This is a real challenge, and I don't think we know the answer for that. A lot of the activity that I mentioned a moment ago is perhaps easiest to start if you're in a community that has extra money to spend on buying high-quality meats or farm-raised cheeses, farm-made cheeses, or on-farm butter. And a lot of this activity really is kind of a gourmet specialty matter. And there's a big discussion nationally about how do we really get foods like this that are healthier foods and also build more wealth for neighboring farmers to the average consumer. I don't think we know the answer to that yet. I think that it's actually a matter of creating the infrastructure again that supports community food activity. We have an infrastructure now that's very good at shipping 54-car trains of grain massive distances across the country, and normally very good at getting grain shipped up and down the Mississippi River Valley to the Port of New Orleans when that's open. We're very effective at hauling large quantities of frozen or dried foods that can be transported without much spoilage.
Speaking of which, if you just think about this for a second, and you talked about 54-car trains, so that coming out of the northern part of Illinois and in the La Salle, Peru, Ottawa area, there are train loaders, and they're loading trains with corn. They're shipping them to Hereford, Texas, where they're fed out to the feedlot for the cattle there. There's not another market, really. I mean, 50% of the U.S. corn and bean crop is fed to livestock domestically. So this is not a, these aren't products that consumers are going to eat out of the field. And I'm not sure that everybody understands that's the case. So are you talking about the flip side of that is that while they're shipping this to Hereford, Texas, they're allowed to put livestock on the ground in Hereford, Texas, in Illinois and Ohio, and points to the east. It's not as friendly to livestock. I think Minnesota may be that way as well, Wisconsin. And that these developments from the urban side and from the environmental side have hampered maybe your ability to discuss the kinds of programs that you think might might work, simply because logistically and regulatorily, you can't put livestock underground to allow this to happen.
Well, and that's partly, again, because the scale of livestock operations has become so big that things like waste treatment become a very big, a much bigger issue than...
Well, even in Illinois, fairly small livestock lots have to be regulated.
Well, the regulation, of course, but there's a bigger problem when you have more waste being generated in one place, and you can still regulate small, but have a smaller waste stream to regulate. What I think is really interesting about the story you're telling is that essentially, farmers in this country are producing commodities that are really raw materials for further processing. If I'm raising soybeans and 95% of the soybeans is turned into animal food, what I'm raising is a raw material. It's not food for humans. If I'm raising animals for a feedlot that get processed in a large-scale processing plant, I'm essentially raising protein to be processed. And so you have an economy that's very good at selling and trading those commodities to large purchasers. And what you have are huge imbalances when it comes to farmers who want to produce food for neighbors who actually would eat the food. And I think the classic story I've come up with in my research comes from Wright County, Iowa, where a group of local people decided to try to reconnect their farm economy so it really opened the doors for local farmers to raise food for local people. And we cared about hunger in the county. We found out there were 400 hungry families in the county who were collecting $300,000 a year food stamps. And it turns out there's only 700 farms in the country, almost twice as many farms as there are hungry people. Those 700 farms collect $25 million producing crops that nobody eats.
Directly.
At a loss. Well, and in fact, in that county, much of that production is corn and soybeans, which really are not, you know, They're not human food. They're not something that I could go to if I went to the field and ate it. It wouldn't be very tasty, because it's really hybrids that are developed for industrial purposes, for raw material purposes, not for human food.
Yeah, the beans go into vegetable oils. The corn, some of the corn, if it's food grade quality, goes into corn chips and such. But most of it is
bad. But it has to be processed first.
Actually, the beans show up in a lot of food. That's a bit of a misnomer. Soybeans show up. If you start looking at any food product, just pick one up and you'll see the label says soybean or soybean oil or something from the bean meal. It's amazing what the soybean does go into directly.
It's pervasive, and of course corn syrup is very pervasive.
Sure, and that goes in and that goes into your drinks.
The point I'm making is if you're producing soybeans for soybean oil or for cattle feed or for animal feed or whatever,
sure,
you're producing for a market that's not humans who eat food. And maybe it ends up in the food supply later. But the consumer demand you're meeting has nothing to do with the neighbors down the road who need to eat three times a day. And so when you separate the producer from those people who really ultimately eat, you have imbalances of supply and demand. You have big transportation, big energy costs, and you have consumers in urban areas who really have no clue that milk comes from cows, have no idea where vegetables come from. And those things are really pretty fatal to our ability to feed ourselves, to know how to cook right, to know the source of health that should be nourishing us three times a day. And in the meantime, we're subsidizing this very, very efficient commodity economy that, you know, we subsidize because we somehow think it's about feeding human beings. And, you know, it's really not very directly true. So the whole basis for our farm subsidies really is kind of questionable. Because, you know, we support farms because we think they're feeding people. Well, yes, they are, but they're really much more about raw materials production.
And although haven't they always been? I mean, with the exception, well, when every farm had livestock on it, maybe that was the case when you had chickens and eggs and you had pigs and beef cattle. But what we've simply, is it not the case that we've simply taken most of that livestock and confined it in one way or another? And then, because that was easy enough to do, that confinement made it economically more viable, I suppose, for larger food distribution, and so that you separated out those things. I mean, what you couldn't do is you couldn't confine land for production, and so that the inputs that go into the livestock industry couldn't be confined into, you know, large greenhouses someplace, that it just took too much. I mean, we raised 11.8 billion bushels of corn last year and put that into the livestock industry in the United States, and it was fairly big.
Right, but and you can continue to do that as long as you don't have to pay for all the costs of externalities that are produced by that. When you are having big streams of waste that affect water tables, that affect.
But on the flip side, it's easier to regulate those very large livestock production facilities because there are so few of them, and you regulate them very much like you regulate corporate America, the rest of corporate America.
Well, regulating the large is not always more effective than regulating the small.
Oh, and then of course, if you've got them spread out over 50 states, and you have them all across all counties more evenly, it's if you take what you end up doing if you spread manure over a great distance and large fields, then you don't notice it. But if it's all concentrated, you do. So I understand the difference between these two. I guess I'm playing a bit of a devil's advocate with you.
Well, of course, that's a good role for a reporter. But I think that the point that, I've actually been doing research on efficiencies in farming, and it turns out, big feedlots, look efficient if, as long as you're able to delay many of the other costs in terms of water quality and so on that occur downstream and 50 years from now. But when you take those costs into account, you find that smaller operations are really fairly efficient. And what's really stunning is that years of academic research has shown that the most efficient size for most kinds of farming, not all, but most kinds of farming are most efficient at a one- or two-person operation. And despite that being the most efficient size, farms have gotten bigger, not because it's more efficient, not because it's a better way to produce food, but, if you get bigger, you can have a bigger cash stream, you can make more money. So, and of course, you can also collect better subsidies. So there's a whole artificial system forcing us to make farm production bigger, which is wiping out our communities.
I saw research today, and I don't remember where it did come from, but it was showing, I do remember where this came from. The National Association of Farm Broadcasters had surveyed farmers to get an idea what radio listenership was, but they also surveyed about the number of farmers there might be on an operation, and I think it's at 2.8 now on the for those who are under age 40, and 2.3 for those who are over age 40. So you're still in that low area for the number of farmers, but these would be grain farmers, and grain farmers can be fairly large and cover lots of area by themselves. Livestock farmers are a different sort of thing that they
We also have a lot of operations where brothers-in-law and sisters-in-law will network a group of four or five farms that are each maybe two people running the farm, but they work in combine in concert, so that you have essentially five or six farms in one unit, sharing equipment and reducing some of the cost that way. And a lot of these farms that are family farms still operate much more of a kind of large-scale corporate structure, because they found incentives that make that work.
Mm.
Yes, the backbone of our farm economy still is family-based agriculture, and that's a good thing, and it's more productive than making farms even larger.
7 or 8 minutes left. What kind of message would you like to send about farm aid or about the research that you've been doing?
Well, I think first of all, about farm aid, it's a terrific celebration of rural people getting some prominence for all the risks that rural people shoulder. Farming is one of the riskier occupations in this country, and people are really going through great sacrifice to produce pretty high-quality commodities at a loss. And this is a chance to get together and kind of assess, where are we, how do we make this better, and how do we change this to be more sustainable for our farm families, for our rural communities, even for urban consumers. In terms of the data that I'm going to bring, I think the real take-home for me is that the way we're producing food in this country really is not sustainable. It's driving farmers broke. It's driving rural communities into a place where they really have no real way of either creating wealth for themselves or retaining young people or having a really solid financial future. It's also causing a lot of difficulties in many regions around water quality and other environmental spinoffs from the way we produce food, and we're very dependent, extremely dependent on energy right now, so that as oil prices go up, we're going to face some real tough choices about how much we can afford to be hauling food around the United States. We're also coming to a place in December of 2005 where the United States will become, on a pretty much permanent basis, a net importer of food, so that all of our assumptions about being dominant in world trade are going to go out the window. A lot of our assumptions will have the clout and the financial capacity to regulate our farm economy with subsidies will go out the window. We're getting pressure from the World Trade Organization right now to reduce our subsidies because it's been ruled a trade-distorting process. And we have some real big choices to move from supporting commodities to supporting communities, where we use federal money not as a cash flow that helps bankers get interest payments back, and not as a way of raising land prices, and not as a way of promoting larger farms than we can afford. But we really take federal money to be an investment in making rural communities healthier by increasing conservation practices, by building local food facilities that maybe warehouse foods that are going to be raised by local farmers and sold to local people, by creating some infrastructure that helps local people know who their farmer is, know for a food security purpose that the food is being produced by a healthy farm, by someone they know, someone they can go talk to, someone whose farm they can work on for a day if they want to, and that they really are able to understand the source of food and be sure it's healthy and not wonder where it came from. So there's a terrific need to just really rethink almost all of our habitual assumptions about the farm economy. And I think the data provides a really compelling case for why we need to do that, what some of the issues we're going to confront are going to be, and I think also give us some hope for really making things better. My first study was in southeast Minnesota. We did a study of 7 counties in that region. We found out that in the year I did the study, if local people bought 15% of their food from local farmers, it would bring as much money into the region as all the farm subsidies coming in from the federal government now. It's a very hopeful thing when you realize that we have the choice to make those things different with our own consumer choices. We don't have to wait for Washington to set a policy. We can start making those decisions to reconnect with our neighbors, reconnect with the source of our food, and to really improve our local economies in ways that will give us much more power and actually, frankly, much more stable lives.
Is it your opinion that these kind of changes must happen at the farm and consumer level, so that consumers literally have to change their buying habits in order to make this, and I hesitate to use this word, but almost idyllic way of garnering food work, that the consumer really has to think about where food is produced and how they want to purchase it?
Well, clearly, consumers have to sort of get serious about knowing the source of their food. They have to start making some choices about how do I know that this food is safe for me? How do I know that the person who raised this and the people who handled it in the meantime really were doing the right practices? And we kind of count on the government to inspect things, but we also know that that can have some dilemmas in it to do that. It really involves kind of rolling up your sleeves and getting to know the producers. And it also means sitting down with them directly and saying, how can I as a consumer make your life as a farmer better, and how can you as a farmer work to make my life as a consumer better, and how can we cooperate in this instead of seeing each other as kind of antagonists in a food economy where the farmer's getting squeezed for the price and the consumer's getting fairly low-priced food, but it's not always healthy for them.
One other quick tangent that I'd like to go on before we have to finish up. You're not looking really at the European model, where everything is labeled from which by nation as to where it comes from. You're looking far more local and community than that, right?
I think ultimately you really don't know the source of your food unless you know the farm it came from. It's not enough to know that it came from China or Chile. You just don't know the practices of the producer unless you can say, I know this person. So I really personally, and this is not necessarily a popular view, but I believe we have to be able to trace right back to the farm of origin. And, of course, our marketing systems are going that way with computers and with scanning technology. The value chains that distribute food are really moving to a situation where they will know exactly which farm it comes from and exactly which warehouse and which store it ends up in. So we just should pass that information on to consumers so that we can make informed choices when we're buying. But the other thing is that won't mean much to know that it came from XYZ farm in Montana if I can't get out there to visit it. So it'll make a lot more connection and sense if I can say this came from somebody I know who lives within 15 miles of my house.
Yeah, that second portion takes some effort on the consumer side, because the first part where that animal ID is already starting to be ramped up by the U.S. government, and you will be able to actually know where your animal was raised, I suppose, if you start looking hard enough. But to have one raised locally would be a different subject.
It would be a very different subject, and it's not strictly a matter of farmers making this change. It's really about, again, building infrastructure and systems that are local that allow us to share some of the risks and rewards of producing food and eating food. And, it might involve my owning part of the shares of stock of the processing plant where the animals are processed. It might involve my owning shares in the farmer's market or in the retail store where I trade my food, because that's creating more of a flow of wealth that cycles within a community instead of just walking away.
Ken, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And that was an interview that Todd Gleason conducted earlier this week with Ken Meador. Let's turn things over now to Todd Gleason in the Agriculture Office. He has the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade, and I think he's also going to tell us a little bit about the gentleman he interviewed.
You bet. Thanks much, Celeste. It would help if I opened my microphone up, just looked down and pulled the wrong pot up. Ken Meador is with the Crossroads Resource Center, interviewed him on Tuesday of this past week. He'll be in Champaign-Urbana Wednesday, September the 14th at 7:30 in the evening at the National Soybean Research Center. A title of a presentation he's making there, Following the Money, Keeping the Food Dollar Closer to Home. That's sponsored by the University of Illinois, the Agroecology and Sustainable Agriculture folks, Dan Anderson and company. If you are interested and you want more information on that, you can pick up where he's going to be off the FarmAid website at farmaid.org, or you can call Dan Anderson in the Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences here on the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences at the U of I. His number is 217-333-1588. It's part of the kickoff series for FarmAid, the 20th anniversary. Champaign to Chicago. They'll be making a traveling caravan from Champaign to Chicago to kick off FarmAid. That all happening as we ramp up to FarmAid September the 18th at the Tweeter Center in Tinley Park, Illinois. Now let's take a look at what the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade afternoon look like. September wheat had a high today of 309. They're low at 303.5. A settlement price there at 309. They were up 5.5 cents for the day. December futures 325. The high, the low at 317.5. Settled at 323.5, up 4.75. March contract 338, the high, the low at 331.5, settled at 336.75, up 3.5. And the May futures 343, the high, the low at 340. Settlement price up on that high at $3.43 a bushel, 4.5 higher for the May soft red winter wheat. And next year's July contract, the harvest month, up 4.5 cents for 2006, the high at 348.5, the low at 42. And the settlement price at $3.47. From the corn pit, September contract nearby 205, high, low at 202.5, settlement price at $2.02. They were a penny and a half lower. December futures down 1.25 as well. 218.25 the high, the low at 215.75. December corn settled $2.16, down a penny and a quarter. March futures 229.5 the high, the low at 227. Settled at 227.25. They were down a penny and 3/4. In the May futures, 236.25 the high, the low at 234. Settlement price at $2.34, down a penny and 3/4. July contract 241.75 on the high, the low at 239.25. Settlement price at $2.39.5, down 1.75. September corn 247.5 the high, the low at 245. Settled at $2.45. They were down 2 cents. September oats 151.5 the high, the low at $1.50. Settled at $1.50.5. They were up 2.5 for the day. And December futures in the oat pit up 1.25 at the Chicago Board of Trade 152.75. 3/4 the settlement price there. Soy complex now, beans September contract, 5.95 the high, the low at 5.90, settled 5.90 and a half, down 4 and a half. November's were off 5 3/4, $6.50 the settlement price. The high at 6.05, the low at 5.99 and a half. Once again, the November bean settled at $6.50. They were down 5 3/4. January futures, 6.13, the high, the low at 6.07 and a half, settled 6.08, down a nickel. And the March contract down 4 1/4, 6.16 and a half, the settlement price. The high at 6.20, the low at 6.14. Soybean meal, September contract, 184.50, the high, the low at 182.30, settlement price at 184.40. They were off 40. And the October bean meal down 1 at 184.90. September bean oil, 22.40, down 22, the high at 22.58, the low at 22.30. And the October contract, 22.45 from the Board of Trade, down 23 for the soybean oil. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the Mercantile Exchange numbers.
Okay, Todd, livestock prices were higher today. September feeder cattle, the high 113.60, the low 112.25, the settlement 113.45, that up 145. October 112.35, the high 110.65, the low, the settlement 112.15, that up 172.5. November feeder cattle, 111.45, the high 109.82.5, the low, the settlement 111.32.5, that up 150. October live cattle, 83.85, the high, 82.90, the low, 83.45, the settlement, that up 52.5. December, 86.90, the high, the low, 85.92.5, the settlement, 86.55, that up 65. October lean hog, 63.30, the high, 62.10, the low, the settlement, 62.75, up 87.5. December lean hogs, 62.02 and a half, the high 60.87 and a half, the low, the settlement 61.57 and a half, that up 70. February lean hog, 62.90, the high 61.92 and a half, the low, finishing at 62.65, up 62 and a half. April lean hog, 60.55, the high 59.85, the low 60.37 and a half, the settlement, that up 45. And February bellies, today's high 81.80, the low 80.30, the settlement 81.02 and a half, that up 107 and a half. And now let's take a look at what's happening on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is currently down 48 points at 10,585. The NASDAQ is down 5 at 2167. The S&P 500 is off 5 points at 1232.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
A writer goes undercover into the world of the white-collar unemployed. She finds coaches and counselors who say they can help job seekers.
The gist of it all was blaming the victim. That if you were in a bad situation now, like having been laid off, it must be your fault.
Barbara Ehrenreich's Bait and Switch, and the latest from the Gulf Coast, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 WILL Urbana.
Coming up later this afternoon on The World from PRI, many survivors of the 1994 Rwanda genocide have been keeping